Do you love Making Movies Is Hard and you want to listen to more episodes?
Jump over to our Patreon page at patreon.com/MMIH and you can listen to the entire back catalog of episodes for just $1.99 a month.
That's an additional 300 episodes that aren't on iTunes that you can listen to whenever you please.
But without any more blibber blabber, back to the show!
You know, making movies is hard.
Making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is a podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Purcell, the founding host of the podcast. I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker, and my first feature film, The Alternate, is out now on digital and DVD and Tubi.
I'm Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer, who's made two features, Bread and Butter and Speed of Life, and I'm currently in development on 15 million more, but really I'm focusing on Best Friends Forever, my horror comedy feature. I'm a distribution consultant who does sales, and I used to manage Sundance's creative distribution initiative.
On this Thursday bonus episode, we're going to play the interview from episode 168, way back from August 5th in 2018, with filmmaker Jean-Luc Julien, who talks about moving to Berlin and how he managed to make his first feature on a very, very low budget while living in Berlin and being from America, which is kind of amazing. Like, I was just blown away by the fact that he just moved to Berlin and is making movies there. Crazy. I felt like this was a good pairing for our episode with Jay because they're both documentary filmmakers who push the genre in different directions. Like, I believe Jean-Luc's movie is kind of like part real life, like exploration of like him as a filmmaker, like going to Cannes. But then it's partly like a documentary about like making a movie at the same time. It's like kind of this weird genre bending, like art imitating art sort of thing weirdness. So I kind of felt like it was a good matchup for Jay. And like, you know, but one is doing it, you know, in Europe and one's doing it in Los Angeles. So I kind of thought it was like a nice, you know, little mix up there. But after we have this interview, don't go away because we have another round of the game that we play. But first, don't forget to support us on Patreon, www.patreon.com/MMIHpodcast. This is the way that the show continues. You know, we give access to our entire back catalog if you do $1.99 a month or more. So that's like over 300 episodes that you'll get access to that you know no one else can hear right now. So make sure to check that out. But without any more bibble babble, here is our throwback interview with Jean-Luc Julien.
And we're here today with Jean-Luc Julien, who is currently working on a documentary called Living in Limbo, which he says covers a lot of the themes that we discuss on the podcast. All I've seen is a trailer, and I think he's right. I've also read the one sheet that you sent us, Jean-Luc, and it does sound like it's a lot about struggle of a filmmaker named Mark, who actually is you, it seems like your alter ego. Anyways, I'm not going to set it up anymore. Welcome to the podcast first.
Thank you. Thank you very much, guys. It's cool being here.
And then why don't you tell us what your documentary is about?
Right.
Give us a little short synopsis.
Here you go. This is what it's about. It's all about this coups. No. It's about a middle-aged American director trying to make the jump from short film to feature film while immersing himself in the international film festival circuit.
And the next question I was going to ask you is give us your 1 minute bio. And I'm guessing it's a similar setup right there.
That's very presumptuous, Timothy. Not sure I like your tone. Yeah, it is similar. You called me out on that one. I was born in Germany. I moved to America when I was 8 months old. So I grew up 7 years in New Jersey, then the rest in California in the Los Angeles area. I moved back to Germany in 1995. And I've been living here for 23 and a half years now. Still trying to make movies.
Why did you stay in Germany and not, like, if you wanted to make movies and, you know, pursue a career in filmmaking, like, why not move back to Los Angeles?
This is a common question I've received and have not yet perfected it, but yeah.
There's wrong answers here. Just do your best. I know. Sometimes it gets complicated.
I mean, we get that question all the time, just you know, like 6 hours away from LA.
Right,
so
LA.
I'm just curious. Yeah.
No, it's a good question. I decided to come here for a year just to try it out. I left LA because there was a drive-by shooting on my street on Halloween in Pasadena and three kids were shot dead, 13, 14-year-old gang retaliation. A neighbor got a bullet through his wall and I just thought, I don't know if I need to live like this and my career wasn't really anywhere where I had to give anything up, so I thought I'd try for a year, and then 23 and a half years later, I'm still here. And a lot of Germans have trouble understanding why I would leave Los Angeles to come to Germany to make movies. But I like, and yeah, it totally makes sense. Yeah, I like the way of life here. I like the seasons. I mean, yeah, I could move to different parts of America. And after 23 and a half years, obviously, most of my connections are here. I also work as an actor and a voice artist, so most of the sound studios I know are here, and I've been very blessed to be able to make a living as an actor and a voice talent. So if I were to move back, I'd basically have to start from scratch and worry about paying rent and all that kind of thing.
Right. And you must speak fluent German by this point, right?
I do, yeah. My mother's German, so she used to speak to me as a kid, so I had a little head start. And I took 2 years in high school, 2 years in college, and yeah, so I speak. It's not perfect, but it works.
Is that why you picked Berlin, because you already had like a little background with the German language and stuff?
Yeah, I considered doing trying France, Paris, but then I realized since I'm a French citizen, hence my name, I'd actually have to do 10 months obligatory military service. So I thought, well, I don't want to do that. So I moved to Germany. Little did I know a year later that the French could actually have me arrested and force me to do military service, even though I was living in Germany. So that turned into a fun little side fight. But yeah, I didn't have to do it in the end.
And how are you making a living? What's your day job?
I guess I don't have a day job. My day job is trying to make movies for no money. But every now and then I get an acting job. They do these co-productions with Germany sometimes. Like they shot Inglourious Basterds here in Berlin. I acted with Samuel Jackson in a movie they shot in southern Germany. So every now and then they need native speaking American actors. And then I do a lot of voice work for cartoons or audiobooks, commercials. Yeah.
So you're full-time filmmaker, actor.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at my IMDb, it has mostly acting credits. And it's funny, I don't really consider myself an actor, but I do it. No one. The problem is no one pays me to direct, but they pay me to act and talk into a microphone. So
yeah, hey, welcome to the club. That's kind of the story out there. It's really hard to get paid to direct, and almost everyone has some sort of side hustle. It's awesome that you're doing stuff that's like related to film, at least.
Yeah, I mean, you're directing commercials, right, Timothy?
Yeah, on occasion. The last one I directed though was almost a year ago at this point.
Okay. But even like one commercial, I mean, if I was paid to direct a commercial, I would feel very satisfied with that.
I mean, you should. I know
the goal is feature films and full time. I understand that. And
well, Timothy's never satisfied. That's the bottom
line. I'm never satisfied. Exactly.
Thank you. Probably something good about that.
But I wanted to say too that previous guest on the show, Paul Schneider, who's a commercial director living and working in Los Angeles, he always says the same thing. Just like, you know, it's really hard to get your next job, and he's been doing it for 30 years, and he still doesn't, you know, have any security at all as a commercial director, no matter how many, national TV spots he directs. So it's like, it's tough for everybody.
Always a struggle,
Always a struggle, exactly.
Yeah.
I hear you.
What's the film community like out there in Germany? We've had a listener that's in Strasbourg, which is on the border of France and Germany. She was kind of complaining that there's not a lot of film work out there and trying to figure out where to go, and we had no idea what to tell her. But since you live there, can you let us know, like, is there a film community? How big is it? Does it exist outside of Berlin, or is it only in Berlin? Kind of what does it look like?
Well, it's lucky you guys ran into me, isn't it?
It really is.
Okay. There's a big film community in Berlin. The two biggest feature film and I guess documentary cities in Germany would be Berlin and Munich. So the north and the south. And Cologne does a lot of television work. So depending on what the listener from Strasbourg is interested in, either Munich or, I guess Munich is closer for he or she.
But it was funny because she didn't seem that excited about Berlin. Granted, you know, she's just graduating high school or whatever and moving on to college, but didn't sound like from her perspective that Berlin was that big of a place for filmmaking. But you're saying that there is a pretty big community there?
Yeah, a lot bigger than Strasbourg. Where did she think would be bigger than Berlin?
Hollywood.
Oh, I thought we were talking about just Germany.
No, she was talking about like trying to decide whether or not to stay in Europe, you know, and then, you know, or go to America, basically.
Right. Okay. And well, in that case, like, yes, Hollywood would be bigger. Yeah.
But I mean, there must be some big, right. Big like areas for filmmaking in Europe, you know, that are like maybe not as big as LA, but they have to like have a pretty big industry there for, you know, to fulfill all the shows and, you know, movies and things that are being made overseas, right?
Yeah, I mean, Netflix just started doing, you know, original programming here the last couple of years. So the series Dark is the first original Netflix series that's in German. And they have their headquarters in Amsterdam, I believe, Netflix. So, yeah, so the big cities, basically, Paris, Berlin, Amsterdam, I think Luxembourg has a big film scene because of tax breaks, perhaps. And yeah, and then the Eastern European, I think a lot of stuff's being done in Budapest as well, because they have really good deals and a good infrastructure for making films, Brussels and so forth. But yeah, usually the main cities are the place to start off.
Is there one that's like bigger than the rest, you know, like one part of Europe that's like really like kicking butt with filmmaking and, you know, video production and stuff like that?
Probably every city thinks they're the one, so I'd have to vote for Berlin. No, I have no idea. I don't hear. I mean, obviously, London's a lot of stuff's going on in London, and the whole Brexit thing's kind of weird. Nobody knows what's going to happen with that. So I assume London would be a good place to go because they do a lot of castings out of London. So I imagine they do a lot of shooting there as well. But I don't know that there's one European central filmmaking city. I think they're all open for co-productions, and they all have their own, you know, since everyone speaks a separate language, different language most of the time.
Yeah, on the commercial side, we go to Europe a lot and we shoot stuff, but we bounce around depending on what the needs are. I know we've shot a few commercials in Barcelona. I know that Prague tends to be a big place if you're doing like, if you need a big choreographed sequence or you need a bunch of like really cool things built. London, of course. Yeah, but I mean, I feel like there's a lot of productions that go there just to take advantage of either, tax breaks, or they need like a bunch of actors to do something, or they need to get a bunch of cool sets built. And it's cheaper to do it there than it is in Hollywood, for instance.
And they don't have to deal with the unions.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm not in the union, the SAG, or any other union, but so, yeah, when they come here, they're shooting non-union and they can pay the actors a lot less. And I'm grateful because work is work. But yeah.
I'm trying to think, like, her complaint mainly with Europe is she just didn't feel like there was, I don't know, maybe she didn't feel like there was enough people for her to get a production off the ground. I know at one point
Especially in her town, I think.
Yeah, in her town. But we're just like, can't you just go to some film festivals? Or is there anywhere? We don't know anything about Europe. I don't even know how close Berlin is to her. But we're like, she was saying at one point, can I just come to the United States for a few months and shoot a short film? As like, wouldn't it be easier to find people around where you are than it would be to like come all the way to a new country and try to like build a team from scratch?
Yeah, I would recommend that as well. But I mean, there's nothing like the experience of saying, yeah, I'm going to LA to shoot a movie, you know, that always sounds nice. But then what I found, the last film I shot in LA was 1998, so that was a while ago, and I had actor friends and people who helped me. But I was just there a couple months ago for the Holly Shorts Film Festival. The monthly screenings were one of my films screened, and I wanted to find someone to help me shoot some stuff for the documentary Living in Limbo, and it's really hard. Everybody wants to get paid, which I understand. I love getting paid myself. But I found that, I mean, I only posted on, what do you call it, Mandy or the filmmaker.
Oh, Andy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, no, I understand everyone wants to get paid, but so for this woman in Strasbourg, I would suggest doing it in Europe because, or at least in Berlin, you can find a lot of people who want the experience and will work for free. You know, it's nice if you provide them something to eat and drink along the way, but yeah, I've never actually paid an actor. And I would very much
How dare
like
you?
To. I know, it's yeah, terrible.
Yeah, as an actor
it's
yourself,
terrible.
You haven't paid an actor. My thing is, you should pay actors. You don't have to pay anyone else, but you should pay actors.
Right, yeah, I don't know why I think that too. Maybe because I can't act. I think maybe that's why I'm like, oh, right. It's such a special thing you do. I must pay you something.
It is. It's a wonderful thing. And as soon as I can get some money or as soon as I can find someone who will give me money to pay other people, then because I produced all my own films and... you know, I did Kickstarter once, raised about $6,000-$7,000. I got funded by in Munich for a film. They gave me $20,000, which was pretty sweet. But I kind of had a name actor attached, a German actor. But yeah, that all went to, you know, closing off roads and equipment. And you know how it is. I don't have to tell you about it. But I would love to be able to pay someone. And that's why I'm kind of in this state, living in limbo, so to speak. Yeah, I mean, you can make a film for a couple thousand, but to make a feature, you need a couple more, and to actually pay people, you need a couple, you know, and right. And then you need investors.
Need a couple more, yeah. So I know we want to get to the Cannes short film corner and hear about your experience with that, but before we talk about that, I have a question. So this Living in Limbo movie that you're making, it's about a filmmaker trying to make their first feature while navigating the international film festival circuit or whatever. But, I mean, like, do you have a movie that you're also trying to make as well while you're making Living in Limbo? Or did you just, or is Living in Limbo the movie that you're making, you know, as your first feature?
So I shot a short film just called Limbo. It's just Limbo. That's the name of it. And it was invited to the Cannes Short Film Corner. And I woke up on a Sunday morning thinking, why don't I make a movie about this guy who has a movie in Cannes? And it's similar to my story, but I don't want it to be just about me. I want it to be kind of about everybody and not only filmmakers, you know, like dreams, following your dreams and, or giving up on your dreams, kind of, midlife crisis thing. Should I keep going? Should I not? What started off as a mockumentary is slowly turning more and more into a documentary all the time. you know, it's supposed to be funny too and poignant at the same time.
But you're still playing the character during the documentary though, right? Even though it's getting more serious, you're still being this other guy.
I mean, the other guy is me. You know, I'm just leaving certain things out. I mean, I killed someone once and I don't want that in. No, I'm joking. I'm joking. you know, I'm just trying to keep like my personal life out of it and just focus on this one character who's driven. I mean, if there's any financiers out there that say, I love the idea, but it has to be you. And it has to be your name on it, then, you know, give me some money and I'll do whatever it takes.
You're like, no problem. Yeah. We'll change that right away.
Right. No, at the moment, I have more fun with it if it's a fictional character. I mean, I don't know if you both saw the trailer.
Well, we'll post it up on our website, but okay. I was going to just say, like, I can see how it would be easier for you to jump into this idea thinking, oh, I can make this more entertaining if it's a fictional character. Like, yeah, I'll be drawing upon my real life experiences, but it's not going to have the weight of me and my experiences if I can like fictionalize this guy's background. And I can still say the same things about being a filmmaker with dreams and maybe feeling like a lot of times that they're just out of reach, but then I can do it in more of a fun way if it's a fictional character.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, in the screen, in the trailer or teaser or whatever, I go along the harbor, and there are all these yachts, these huge yachts in Cannes. And I go and ask, are there any producers on the yachts? Right. And I actually met a producer on the yacht who invited me on and we talked and he said, and I would never do that in real life. You know, I mean, I'm terrible at networking for one thing. I don't like just going up to complete strangers saying, I need something from you. But playing this character and having a camera following me allowed me, kind of gave me the courage to kind of play with it and get silly and then see what happens. So yeah, I guess it helps.
It's got a little bit of a Morgan Spurlock feel to it, maybe a little Michael Moore in there. But yeah, I thought it seemed like a very entertaining take on, you know, what it's like to be a filmmaker and attending these festivals. And Alric and I have been to festivals, and I think we had dreams that, like most filmmakers do, that you're going to go to a festival, especially something like Cannes, and it's going to really propel your career. Did you have those kind of expectations going to the Cannes Short Film Corner? Did you know anything about it before you went? And were you like, oh man, this could be my big break. I just got to find a producer there.
Right. No, I'm a little too old for that now. I did.
You know, buy into the dream.
Yeah. No, I'm just a bitter old. No. I actually went to the Cannes Short Corner when they first did it about 10 years ago, and at that time, I think they took everything or anything, any film.
Oh, really?
And now they have a selection, I guess, because everybody can make a movie now. They say they have an artistic, creative kind of, I don't know, level that they want to reach. I don't know if that's true, but yeah. So I already knew, and I know because I'm a terrible networker, that yeah, it probably wouldn't get me anywhere. So I did not have the dream.
Okay.
But I also open the option of that happening. You know, it's not like
sure,
I'm that
you always have
up.
To.
Yeah.
We had somebody on our indie filmmaker group on Facebook ask about the Cannes Film Corner, I believe. Alric, do you remember?
Yeah. Yeah. Somebody was curious about whether or not they should go. And like, my understanding is that a lot of people get into the short, Cannes Short Film Corner, that it's like a pretty, I think I even got in for one of my movies and I just was like, I don't want to go.
Because
I'd
in?
Already heard. I think so.
I know. I can't believe it. Alric actually got it.
Even I got it.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, so. Not to say that it's a bad thing or anything, but I just feel like it's a pretty big expense to go all the way out to Cannes, you know, to be just, you know, part of this program that, you know, is not, you know, there are a lot of people get into and there's a lot of competition, you know, and probably a lot of people who are there, like really excited about being in that corner. And so I really feel like it's all about your networking ability at that point, you know?
Yeah.
But I mean, again, it's better than like just going to Cannes without being in the short film corner, I think.
Right,
you know, which
definitely
plenty of people
is,
do
yeah.
also.
And they have an accreditation.
I think I said something very defeatist on Facebook. I was probably one of the first people to respond. And
of course.
I probably just said like, I probably said some statistic like, you know, 2,000 films get submitted to Cannes Short Film Corner. I don't think it's a big deal. Like, you probably shouldn't waste your money or something like that.
Right. I think I found a friend of mine who had gone before for her movie. And I think she gave it her answer on, like, what she thought it was like or what her experience was. So I think that was helpful to that person.
There's an interesting article online.
That is. I did find that, and
yeah,
I did put that on Facebook.
And it's pretty accurate, and I kind of knew that already going in, and I went to a couple film lectures, and I asked this one producer about it, and he said, yeah, don't waste your time. The only reason those people, like the Sundance senior programmer is there is because they fly her down there and they put her up in a hotel and they give her food and, you know.
Right, and who doesn't want to go to Cannes?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's great to experience because you get, well, I didn't get a single ticket for one thing. They have like a lottery ticket the last time I went. They keep changing how they hand out the tickets. And you can go if you're accredited without a ticket to other screenings. But like the big screenings at the Palais, there you need a ticket. So yeah, just to experience it, it's probably nice.
But what is it? So there's the Cannes Film Festival, and then there's the Short Film Corner. Do they actually screen movies in a theater, or is it just like a catalog, like actually a corner of a room where they just have like a catalog of films you can look through? Like, what is it?
It's part of the market, the film market, and it is not like it's a bigger corner, I guess you could say, within the market. And there is like a room where they have, I don't know how many monitors, maybe 15, 20 monitors. And anybody can go in there. You have to kind of make a reservation and you go up there and say, when's the next slot? Or can I do it tomorrow at 3? And apparently they have short film buyers, short film distributors that are looking for content. So they can go in there and they can search by genre or length. And I think they had 14,000 views or something. I wrote it in the synopsis, but I had 3 views over 7 days of my film. I didn't promote my film at all. And one person I met there who was a producer, I asked him to watch the whole thing. And the other 2 people only watched 90 seconds of it. So no one actually watched my whole film.
How long was the film?
10 minutes.
Okay.
And what genre is Limbo?
Drama.
Oh, okay.
So maybe they're looking for comedy or sci-fi or I don't know.
So here's a question for you. So you go to the short film corner at Cannes, and then you've got your drama short that you made that's gotten in. How much of your energy are you putting into like making the documentary when you're there at Cannes, and how much are you putting into like trying to actually, you know, make connections for your drama short and like get that side of your filmmaking career going?
Yeah, that made this trip a lot harder, but I think I justified going to the short film corner because I was making a documentary. So obviously when I'm there, I'm trying to meet people, and it even gave me an opportunity to interview people that I wouldn't normally be able to interview and to get their feedback on the festival and connections. And I was looking for a producer and asking help. Do you know how I can find a producer? So, I had somebody with me, a cameraman from Hamburg, for 3 days. And yeah, we shot for 3 days. And, but yeah, they have like events at the short film corner. They have like happy hour where you can meet other people, but they're mostly people, you know, like us, you know, that they're mostly directors that are there hoping to meet a producer. So it seems like you're just in a big room full of the same people. No one can help anybody else, you know what I mean?
Right.
And they're coming from all over the world. So, you know, you could meet a producer and they're from Tokyo or something.
Yeah. It's interesting. That's like the SF Film Society parties I've gone to recently are like that. You know, you see the same people at each party. They're all directors, writers, and producers, and everyone's looking for financing, and, you know, no one can really help each other out besides like maybe 5 people in the room who you don't know who those people are, or
they don't want you to know.
Project. Right. maybe not. I don't know.
That's maybe
a little more cynical.
A little.
But, anyways, I mean, but yeah, it can be very, daunting, but I feel like it's still really good to go to those parties and those events because then you meet more people, and then you never know, like the one person you meet might, you know, spark something else in your career that you couldn't even foresee, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I know it might sound cynical, but, I am open for things to happen. I'm not, you know, I mean, I wouldn't go there for no reason. But yeah, I think it's hard to, you know, especially in Cannes, to get into the parties. I know people who crash parties and, you know, they're just those types of people. They really need to be there. And, so yeah, magic does happen. I mean, like I said, I met a producer, an executive producer on a yacht, and he promised to produce anything I wanted to make. But you know, a Hollywood
promise. So are they producing You're Living in Limbo then, or
he doesn't usually do documentaries for one thing. But he said I could use his name as executive producer. I could put him on the list as an executive producer. And I interviewed him. I was in LA, like I said, a couple months ago, and I met up with him again. So it's not like, And he's trying to help me edit it. He hooked me up with an editor in LA.
Basically, when a producer, I think what the thing that most filmmakers tend to find is that they think they need a producer because they feel like a producer is going to bring money. But then what they find out is that you can find a producer that'll produce your film, but they're not going to bring the financing. They're going to wait till you bring the financing, and then they'll help you get the film made. That's what's happened to me. I think that's what's happened to Ulrich. It sounds like that's kind of what happened to you too.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I'd like to think producer equals money, or that they would find the money, but that might be very naive. I understand paying a producer to actually produce something. That makes sense, like paying actors and directors and so forth.
Yeah.
But I just don't know where to get that money, and I assume that producers have more knowledge of that.
It seems to me that just that's what everyone's struggling with. Even producers are struggling
with the money part, you know?
Yeah.
It's the most difficult part of the whole process, and there's no easy answer. And I think, like, you need to, it's just, you gotta figure it out yourself, and figuring it out is, like, so hard. And, like, even, you know, I've had some pretty good success raising money for my feature, but it's still, like, oh my gosh, you know, you'll get like these great like things that happen, and you're like, oh my gosh, like this is gonna like set us off to a new thing, and then of course that opportunity disappears, you know, and then you're like, okay, well I gotta wind up to the next thing, and then it's really just comes down to like little victories, you know, and like one little victory after another little victory after another little victory, and then you just grow your pot, you know, but it's really. Really challenging. I mean, gosh, it's
I think it's rare tough. That people are going to find just one source of funding that they're going to have to go out and maybe apply for grants if their movie fits into that bucket, or get involved in film societies or Sundance Labs if your film falls into that bucket, or just relying on family and friends if that's all you've got. But I think it's really about just taking that first step forward and starting to find the money. And then through finding the money, I think you'll keep finding new avenues to find the money. But if you're just looking for a one-stop shop, you're probably not going to find it that way. It's very rare that we've heard stories of people that just, they have an angel investor come in and drop the whole budget of the movie in their laps, except for J.D. Dillard. I can't think of another example.
Right. Yeah, I haven't even explored that. I guess what I'm looking for more than anything is a collaborator, a teammate, a brother, sister in arms kind of thing. You know, it's just so exhausting doing it all yourself. You know, you hear about great relationships, director producer relationships, and I don't know, just someone who likes producing too, because I've produced all my films and I've gotten them made, and you know, I guess that's successful, but I've never even dealt with trying to get, you know, over 20 grand.
I think the real way to be successful in that is just to find somebody who's gonna, like, I think not find somebody. It's actually not that at all. I think it's really just you making the movie, because in making the movie and getting it done, you'll attract people to the project, you know? I really feel like that's what I've seen work for people in the past, is just doing it, and then, you know, people will come. You know,
it's like starting it, like pretend like you're already in production and you just kind of get the ball rolling and make it seem like it's happening, whether or not people join you or not. And if people feel like it's just going to happen without them, they're more likely to say yes than it's just this idea that's sitting around. So we've learned, and we learned this as early as, like, I think episode 20 was when we had our first guest on, and they're just like, you've got to be your own producer. Like, you can't wait for somebody to come in and do the work for you. I think having more of like a mentor on the side, we just did an episode with Chris Ford, who found a producer just to kind of ask questions to along the way. Like, whenever he got stuck, you just email them and say, all right, I'm here now and I want to get to this point. What do I need to do to make that happen? And they'd give them some suggestions. It's really hard to find somebody that's going to be as passionate about your project as you are. So I think it's really falls on us as the people who have the project that want to make it happen to really push it forward. And so I think the steps are, both with raising money and getting your film made, is just, you just got to start pushing it forward however you can. If all you can do is start casting and finding a location and getting that script done, anything that you can package together and just start making it look like it's something that is going to gain its own momentum, then it makes it easier to like ask other people, do you want to come in on this? I already got actors. I've got a location. I got this script that won a contest. I don't know. Well, you know, whatever you can do to start making it look like it's a thing. For me, it was on Spirit Machine, I did concept art, which was a huge thing, because then it wasn't any part of the filmmaking process except for just visualizing it. But I think people saw how serious I was just to like pay somebody to put together concept art that they're like, oh wow, like you're serious about this. This is not just a script on paper. You're like actually putting work towards it to make it a reality.
Right, absolutely. Well, one of you asked if my first feature is living in limbo or if I'm actually pitching another script. I mean, I do have another feature film that I'd like to do eventually, but at the moment I'm pitching Living in Limbo. So I'm making a movie about trying to make a movie. I'm trying to find it. So, you know, I flew down to Cannes. I convinced two other people to fly down on their own dime. And I cut a little teaser, 3-minute thing. I've been sending it to producers. I've been, you know, so I have something. I've already started. I've invested my own money. But yeah, I just don't want to do it all alone.
Yeah, totally.
Well, that's what I was gonna say. It sounds like you're doing all the right things. You know, you're actually making the movie, and so I think it's just a matter of time until you find somebody who aligns with the film you're making and who wants to jump on board. You know,
yeah, but how do I find those people?
Well, I think you just keep on doing it. Like, you know, you keep on, you know, I don't know what stage you're at. Like, if there's something that you need money for that's stopping you from continuing. But as my experience with documentary, it's like you can just, you know, shoot an interview with basically no lighting, you know, and just go and keep on making it. So I don't know.
It feels like I'm doing now.
Yeah, exactly. So it just seems like you're on the right track. Push it forward.
Yeah, exactly. You're doing it. So don't worry. There's not like something that you're missing. You're doing it.
Oh, and the other thing I was going to say too, that people seem, that I've learned in my whole experience raising money, is that attitude is a big thing that people respond to. So like, if you're a little ho-hum about your project, even if you are doing all the right things, I think people don't get as excited about it. So like the couple meetings where I've been less enthusiastic have not gone as well. But when I'm like the most enthusiastic and the most excited about my project, that's when it really goes well. So I would just say that like always have this like unbridled enthusiasm around what you're doing, like at all times, like, cause you never know when you're going to meet somebody who's going to be interested in it. So like everything I do, like every job, when I'm at the coffee shop, like buying lunch, like whatever. If anyone asks me what I'm doing and like what I'm, you know, ever strike up a conversation, it's always like, yeah, I'm making this movie. I'm really excited about it. Blah, blah, blah. And I pitch it all the time. Like, you know, at lunch when I'm like shooting, you know, I'm driving to a shoot with somebody and carpooling, you know, I'm constantly pitching the movie. So I feel like just doing that, like even if it doesn't actually result in anything tangible, it's like you're putting the positive energy out in the universe. And like that'll eventually come back to you, you know.
That's some Berkeley shit right there.
That damn some straight.
Oh no, yeah, put you that gotta positive keep on energy keeping out on, the man. Universe.
You can yeah. tell which one of us is the positive optimist, and who's the pessimist.
Yeah,
you know.
Right. I wouldn't say I'm a pessimist. I'm just more of a realist. I always
That's what all pessimists say.
Say exactly. That. That's what they say. So I want to talk a little bit about your time in LA. You said, so I was looking at your website and it looks like you started the company in like 2000. And was that like right after you went to film school? Like you went to, Cal State LA experience like?
It wasn't, because there was no film department at Cal State LA, which is actually strange. I actually studied theater, directing and acting theater.
Oh, cool.
And they had a broadcasting department at the time. So that's where I kind of learned editing on the, I don't know even what you call it, those things where you toggle and stuff on VHS or beta or whatever. You
know? Tape to tape.
Yeah, I'm aging myself a little bit now. But so I studied theater and I've been making short films since I was 14, I think, 13, 14. I wrote my first screenplay. And just doing VHS stuff with friends. And then I directed my first play my senior year in college. And then I thought, okay, I don't want to be an actor anymore. I mean, no. I, Yeah, no, I mean, I'd really like the, I think what I excel at as a director is that I'm good at organizing and I'm good at communicating. I'm good at leading. I guess I'm a pretty decent leader. And I think so that's important.
You ended up liking directing more than acting.
Exactly. That's what I meant. So I kind of leaned towards that, and I directed a bunch of theater in LA, not a bunch, maybe three or four plays. And and then I started my own theater company in Germany, and still trying to do both. But at one point, I realized, okay, I can't do theater and film. I have to make a choice, and I decided to make even less money directing short films.
Right. And so your first short film was what, 99, you said?
Yeah. Well, the 2000 thing that my first short that I directed, I was probably 19. It was like a Martin Luther Jr. documentary type thing, and on VHS, and just with friends.
Yeah.
I mean, the stuff that's on IMDb, I started a little later than, you know, we all have a bunch of films we've made that we don't really talk about or screen in front of anybody except family and friends, even then. I guess The Kiss in 2000 was my first film, and I actually shot that on black and white 16mm.
Awesome.
I'm grateful to have gotten a taste of actual film, and I edited it myself, like actually cutting the positive, and then sending it to a negative cutter. So I experienced all that stuff, which was nice. So that's why I said the company has started in 2000. I shot in 98, took me 2 years because
And then how many short films have you made since then?
I think I'm almost reaching 30. And most of the last ones I've done, they've been part of these competitions, like the 48-hour film project. I did a 35-hour one, a 99-hour one. Actual films, I guess Limbo is an actual film that I shot in 2016. One before that. Oh, that's actually screening tonight in New York. There's any New York listeners, the new filmmakers, New York is going to screen my film Limbo. The screenwriter will be there. That's a little shout out to Amy Fruchtman. And then I did another one in 2009 where it was funded by the Bavarian government. I guess just really two kind of planned. But it's funny, these timed competitions actually did surprisingly well and won a couple of awards.
That's cool.
And
So in over these years that you've been making these shorts, are you doing that because you don't know how to get enough money to make a feature, and so this is kind of like in the interim you're making shorts to just like keep things going? Or are you hoping that one of these shorts like hits big and wins a bunch of awards and that helps kind of open the door to the feature thing? Like what kind of path have you been pursuing with all this?
Yeah, the hope is that, you know, people make short films and to hopefully have it as a calling card. And I was really hoping with Limbo that would happen, but it hasn't really caught on at festivals. So why do I keep doing it? I don't know. I don't know what else to do, really.
Can I ask you a very invasive question, which is how much money have you spent on your filmmaking over the past 20 years?
Wow.
Yeah.
Of my own money? I have actually no idea. When I did The Kiss on 16mm, I think the budget was $3,000 that we just used for, you know, film costs. So not really that much. I mean, I guess I've paid a lot of money trying to make this living in Limbo by flying to festivals. I don't know. So maybe in the last 20 years, say $10,000. I mean, the Kickstarter money was from other people. The Bavarian funding was from other people. So not that much. And
that's great.
Yeah,
I guess where I was going with it, I was just curious to know, like, had you just saved that money up, could you have made a feature? And I think there'd be a lot of people out there that say, yeah, you can make a feature with $2,500. I mean, we had Evan Kidd on here that made a feature film for $2,500. But you know, it all depends on like kind of where you're at and what your connections are and how you can make that happen. But I'm guessing that you have a very clear idea about what this feature looks like, and it's not a $2,500 feature.
It's interesting. I've never actually considered it because I like to think, I mean, do you know the budget of Tangerine,
that film? I can look it up really quick.
I mean, they shot it on an iPhone, but I assume they needed lights and permits and stuff like that too. And I don't know if they paid the actors or not. I could shoot a film on
$100,000.
Right. So when you hear someone making a movie on a cell phone, you think, that's all they needed. But you still need other things. So you need $100,000 to do that and to make it look good as it did. I haven't really considered. I mean, maybe that's the option to go. Just put my life savings into it and make a feature film. But I kind of don't like the feeling, you know, they say you should never use your own money, you know, because that's going to affect my directing too. And I'm going to be more stressed on the set with the actors and, you know.
I'm with you. Ulrich, I need you to jump in. You need to tell us, like, should people be spending their own money on their feature films?
I mean, if you can figure it out, on their feature films or on their short films?
Like, if it's
on their features.
If it's like, let's just say $100,000 at the top end. If you have $100,000 and you're just like, I want to make a feature film, is it worth people to go into debt to make it? Because we've heard stories about people that have done it and that been successful with it, right?
I guess it depends.
The Kevin Smiths of the world.
It depends on your situation. Like, if you have $100,000 that you can afford to put into a movie, like, even if it was for, like, you know, if you're saving to buy a house, but, like, you had this $100,000, you know, in the bank, ready to go. I mean, if I had $100,000 in the bank, I would just use it to make my movie right now, you know, and that wouldn't even be the whole budget. But, I mean, at least that would get me there, right? But... you know, obviously not everyone's prepared to do that and not everyone's in that situation. And like for me personally, I spent like roughly around $60,000 across my 3 to 4 short films over 3 to 4 years or 5 years or whatever it was. So, you know, my wife and I made an agreement that I'm not allowed to spend any of my own money on movies anymore, or at least
are you
not
sure that was
to
your
that
wife
degree.
And your agreement?
Well, you
sounds
know,
like a wife agreement to me.
I'm a mature adult. If I didn't want to do that, I could, you know, push back. But I mean, I still spend money on my own movies or my own money on movies. But it's more like paying to go to AFM or paying for, you know, like investor lunches or paying, you know, that's the kind of, or paying for script printouts or for, you know, things like that. But that's all like, you know, a write off from my business. So, I mean, that kind of helps, you know, but, right. But yeah, I mean, I'm sure, and I will probably end up putting in my own money in the movie too. It's just inevitable. It just happens, you know, like you're short $5,000. You know, and then like you need to make it up somehow. So like, okay, well now I'm an investor too. Like that's going to happen. Like I know it, you know, and my wife knows it too. And she's totally cool. But I mean, I guess my point is that if you're in a financial situation where you could literally like just take, you know, $50,000, $100,000 and go make a feature, more power to you, you know, but I think the thing that I've decided for myself is that as filmmakers, we need to figure out how to raise our own money. Like if we're really going to be filmmakers and if we're really going to do this as a career, like that's a portion of it that you need to figure out. So like that's what I'm doing now is trying to figure out how to get the funds, you know, and figure out the whole investor thing and figure out the raising money and, you know, doing my best at it. So it's like, that's the challenge I think that all filmmakers have. And it's kind of cool. Like you've only spent $10,000 on your shorts over, you know, 20 years or whatever it is. And, that's pretty impressive. Cause I mean, I've been, you know, I spent a lot more in a lot shorter amount of time.
Me too.
And so is Timothy, you know, but I just think that, you know, like what you've done with like getting funding from the Bavarian government or getting funding from Kickstarter or getting funding from other things. It's like, those are all things that we should all be thinking about. Like where are the funds? Like where can we get them? Like there's lots of grants. There's a couple grants in the Bay Area that you can go after. The Berkeley Film Society has one, or I can't remember what their name is, but like maybe it's the Berkeley Film Commission. They have one they do every year that they give out a certain amount of money for independent projects. The Film Society in San Francisco has them, you know, and there's a bunch of other ones here that exist. And then there's the bigger ones, you know, like, you know, whatever, the Sloan Grant and this, that, and the other things. So there's lots of things you can apply to, but I mean, those are really, really hard to get.
So they're hard. It's like, very competitive, and you have to have the right film to fit into
And usually you have to have a production company behind you, right? You can't just say, hey, I'm a director. I want to make a movie. Give me money. They want to know that there's a production company behind you and most likely a producer who's produced a couple, at least. Right. That's my guess.
But even just, but just getting through that first, even trying to just, you know, get it done on your own. Like, even if it is, like, they don't require a production company behind you, but you're just submitting as the filmmaker, either the producer or the director, just getting past that first gateway is, like, incredibly difficult, you know? So, but I that's why I feel like trying to find private investment is the best way to go. Like, either through your own personal connections, friends, family, or even just through people you know through the business that you do. I think that seems to be the way that most people are able to find their money is just by, you know, pitching to people that they come across in their lives, you know? And like, people always ask, like, where to find investors? How can I find investors? I really feel like the answer is, wherever you can, you know, whoever, you know,
that answer sucks.
And so how do you do that? You're at the dentist's office and you're in the waiting room. Dentist comes to pick you up. Say, hey man, nice office. You got a little spare change for a movie?
I mean, my dentist is one of my investors. So
no, shut up.
Great.
No,
that's
absolutely.
Such a cliche. That's
true.
Amazing. So wait, how do you do that though? Do you just say, be like, hey man, can I talk to you for like, can I take you to coffee for half an hour and talk to you about this project I'm working on?
Yeah, I think after one of my dentist appointments, I just pulled him aside and was like, hey, you know, I'm making these movies. I'm working on this feature. Would you be interested in, you know, potentially being an investor? And then he was like, yeah, send me more about it. And then he's like, yeah, okay, let's have lunch, you know, this day. And then took him to lunch, did the whole pitch thing, and then he was like, yeah, okay, I'm in for this amount. Let me just clear it with my wife first.
That's amazing.
All right.
And then, you know.
Can you send me his email address?
But that's my dentist who's been cleaning my teeth since I was 5, you know? So it's like sort of a special dentist. It's not just any
Yeah, but you
dentist.
Found an opportunity. I think that the key is you find these opportunities and you find where the money is. And whether or not it's people you even know. I mean, it's great that it's somebody you knew, but for like you, Jean-Luc, it's like if you kind of locate those opportunities and say, all right, what do I need to do to get those people to say yes to me? And you may not be ready right now, but maybe in 2 years you'd be ready by doing certain things. Like maybe you need to have like a super solid trailer to make it happen. Like I know Coen Brothers, the story was they made a trailer and then they went door to door, like selling shares of their movie, projecting the film and talking people into it. When Chris Ford did a similar thing, he made a movie about Reno and went to Reno and like had people come to a bar and screened a trailer for the film and got investors that way. So I think it's about like finding in your specific, we can't guide you because we don't know what your life is like, but looking around you and saying, all right, if there's nobody that I know personally, who are people outside of my network that I need to get in touch with and how do I reach them?
So it seems to me there's two types of investors, right? There's one that want a return on investment, and there's one that just want to be part of the filmmaking world.
Just be part
world.
Of the movie thing, yeah, right. Which is probably, at our level, I think most of the investors we're going to find are just people that want to be a part of the movie-making world.
Well, hopefully all of them, because you don't really want the people who expect a return on their investment, really.
It's because it's hard.
You're not really in a position to deliver that necessarily. So like, hopefully they should be into it because they love the movie, they like you, and they're in it for the experience. So that's really what you're hoping for, you know. Mm-hmm. And they really believe in the project. Like that's what you need them to be thinking. Because if they're thinking like, oh yeah, I'm gonna get rich off this, or oh, this is a solid investment, they're just gonna be pissed off at you later, more than likely, you know.
Yeah,
and you don't want pissed off investors.
I think you could build the story around yourself. Like, hey, I used to live in LA. I'm now here in Germany. I'm making my first feature film. I think that's kind of an impressive story right there.
Yeah, Okay, that's a good way to do it.
I know it doesn't sound impressive to you, but it will sound impressive. You're like, I've been making films for 20 years. I've screened at the Cannes Short Film Corner, you know, list of all the festivals you've been at, the awards.
Yeah, the terrible thing is I could sell you guys as filmmakers better than I can sell myself. You know, I got a real problem telling people how great I am, you know.
Well, maybe you should take on this persona of, is it Mark to do
Mike.
It? Mike? Yeah. Yeah, so Mike can sell you as a filmmaker.
As long as I have this a camera buddy. Behind me.
He's amazing. Yeah, and maybe you just need the camera to be with you the whole time.
I do, all the time, yeah.
What other questions do we got, Ulrich?
Hey, while you're looking at possible questions, I just want to say thanks so much for doing this, just making the podcast. I think you're really supporting the community out there. I mean, there's millions of us, you know. I just wanted to say congratulations to you and that you've done this for 3 years, which is pretty amazing. And I'm sure there are a lot of people, I don't know how many followers or subscribers you have, but the stuff I'm hearing, I'm going through the same thing, so I imagine other people are, and I just want to say thank you from one of your listeners.
Oh, good. Oh,
thanks, man.
Yeah, you're welcome, and I'm glad that we can be some sort of support. We just talk. We don't know what we're doing either.
Yeah, but it's cool that, like I said, I listened to the Variety Playback podcast, and they have interviews with big actors and directors and producers, and and then there's the other side, and that that chasm between those two sides seems to be so huge and so unlikely that it's great that you're just sharing.
You're welcome. I feel like sometimes that chasm feels like it can look discouraging, because you're just like, I'm here on this side of things, and on the other end is like that amazing world of success, and look how green it is over there. I think part of what Ulrich and I are always hoping to do is just to get people on and just remind them, you're doing it. Like, you are finding a way to keep making your films, and that's all it's about. I know you're struggling to like get to that next big thing, and I think you can get there if you just keep pushing for it. But also don't lose sight that you are making it happen, and you're making stuff. And like, you're here on this podcast telling us about this documentary that you're working on, which is really cool and was interesting enough that we wanted to have you on and talk to you. So that's a success.
Cool, man. I'll take it.
So I have a question. So you've been doing this for a long time, and you've never really stopped pursuing the filmmaking craft. So, like, what do you feel like being a filmmaker means to you? What do you have to do in order to have that title? Like, do you need to be making money at it? Is that only the kind of people who can call themselves filmmakers in your mind? Or is it just someone who's actively making movies? Like, do you define yourself as a filmmaker? Like, what does this all mean to you?
I am a filmmaker because I'm making films. It is not about the money. It is not about the fame. It is not about any of that. But I would like to be paid to direct films. I would like to be paid doing what I want to do. And it doesn't need to be a lot of money. I don't need to, like I said, be rich or famous. And maybe one day I'll want that, but I doubt it. And I'd like to pay other people for doing their job, you know, like actors or caterers or, editors. Yeah. There's so many people. And I guess I'm kind of tired of just begging people. And I know people that have worked with me, I've been able to get them paid jobs somewhere else, or people that met on my set ended up working together somewhere else. So, and I've worked for free for plenty of other people as well. And I guess for me to call, I am a filmmaker because I'm making films, and I'm in the process of trying to make more films or getting paid. But I guess for me it would just be, just getting paid like as a living, you know, just wake up and say, I'm a director. Okay, what do I got? I got this producer meeting. I got to meet the writer. I got to, you know, right. and that someone gives me a little money to do it. So I don't have to, you know, think, oh my God, the money's just disappearing.
Yeah. I think that's what we all want.
I think so.
As filmmakers, you know, but I like what you said that you are a filmmaker because you're making films. I think that's what it's about, you know, and the making money from it or the status or the awards or all that other stuff, that doesn't really matter. It's just the fact that you're in the act of making movies is enough for you to be a, you know, a filmmaker. And that's how I look at anyone who works on movies as filmmakers. Like, even if you're a catering person who works on movies, like I consider you as part of the filmmaking process, you know, even though you're not the director or the writer, you know. I know a lot of people disagree with me on that statement, but that's sort of like my mindset, you know, because we're all in it together. Like, we can't do it without the whole team, you know. Yeah. So
I'm also grateful that, you know, people want to see my films. I mean, not all of them, obviously, but I've been sending it to the festival over the last years, and I don't know how many festivals, not the big ones, not Sundance, Tribeca, South by Southwest or whatever, but some smaller festivals actually want to screen what I've done and give awards. And, you know, I know it's easy to get awards now because there's so many festivals out there, and it seems like some festivals
filmmaker bio now says award-winning filmmaker. So I know you're still working on your documentary, but I am curious, you're trying to answer one question with it, which is like, when do you give up on your dreams? Are you going to answer that question by the time the film ends? And do you already have a sense for like what the answer is?
I don't. I guess I'm making the film to find the answer. I don't know. It's kind of all weird, meta or something. I don't know. So the end of the film, I don't know. There's two options. Either, you know, I just accept that after 2 years of trying to make the film, I'm still in the same position. Or I actually get money and actually make the film and screen it in Cannes maybe in 2020 or something, you know, that would be the happy ending. And the other ending is, well, he hasn't achieved anything in the last 2 years really, but he kept trying and good for him. So I don't know. I mean, the age thing, yeah, it's kind of exaggerated, kind of midlife crisis thing. But, yeah, I mean, when you go to this Cannes short film corner, they're young. They're, you know, beginning early 20s, mid 20s. I spoke to this guy at the short film corner and he was 30 and he said, yeah, I know I'm a little late to the game. And I'm going, wow. So yeah, it is a young man's game. And, I'm certainly a little older than I was. I don't know if I'd ever actually give up. I'm interviewing a lot of people about what it means, what success means, what failure is, when you should give up. And yeah, most people say you should never give up as long as you love what you're doing. But I'm not really sure I love what I'm doing because it's exhausting and it's stressful. But it's nice. It's a good feeling.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Wait, yeah. I'm sorry. I'm just curious because Timothy recently has sort of been talking in the same way that, like, you know, he's not necessarily loving the process of being like a director and a filmmaker anymore. So he's like kind of taking a break right now. I'm just curious, like, you know, what is your experience? Are you just getting tired of, you know, the same old thing of like, you know, just really grinding to make a project happen and then like it not really going anywhere? Or like, what makes you say that you're getting tired of it?
It's like going to the gym. I like having gone to the gym. You know, I know it's good for me and, you know, I never enjoyed the process. But I'm glad after I go to the gym, okay, that was probably healthy for me and that's what I should be doing. Maybe it's not a great example because I do love the creative process of filmmaking. I love the collaboration. I love working with actors. I love, you know, script writing. But yeah, usually because I think I've been doing so much as far as producing and directing. And maybe that's why I'm so eager to find a producer, someone who loves making deals, someone loves writing up contracts, someone loves finding money and all that. So I can just focus on directing and I don't have to worry when I know it's we all have this problem, but that we're wearing more than one hat. But that's what I mean when I say it's not fun. It's exhausting. And, but yes, I'm glad I did it. And I love the editing process, working with the editor, finding new ways to make the story better, richer, you know, more entertaining. So the overall process, yes, I still enjoy it. And that's why I still like it. And it's nice when you can make a movie that moves people. You know, it's a wonderful feeling to sit in the movie theater and hear people laugh at jokes or hear people cry. I was at a festival in Waco, and the woman said she cried, and it's just nice to touch people, I guess, move people, and so I guess that's probably why we're making movies too, right?
Yeah. So, do you think you'll ever quit, or do you think you'll just always keep on going?
Keeping on, brother. I don't know what point I would ever quit. I took a break because I was caring for a family member for about 8 years. But I was still like writing and still developing ideas. And I don't know if I'll ever quit. But then sometimes I think, wouldn't it be nice just to like not worry about that and just get a normal job? I know this sounds kind of silly because I'm very blessed because people pay me to act and speak into a microphone, and I haven't had a normal 9-to-5 job for almost 20 years now. So I know it's kind of complaining, but part of me sometimes thinks, wouldn't it be great if someone else just told you what to do every day, you know, and like you went there for 8 hours, you did your job, right. You went out. I mean, it's silly. Nobody really wants that. And it's like Timothy said, it's always greener on the other side. But yeah, so these are the thoughts that go through my mind. And I know deep down that I'm very blessed to be in this opportunity to have the time to actually try to keep making movies.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I've definitely said that same exact thing. Like, it would be nice to just have a day job where you didn't have to worry about trying to find work or all the hustle or whatever, and I just, like, made sandwiches for a living or delivered pizzas or something like that, you know? But then I always snap myself out of it. And then Timothy recently said something very similar to what you just said, which was like, wouldn't it be great if I didn't have to worry about all this stuff anymore, and I just could I don't know, remember how he finished that sentence. But sounds like you're not anywhere near to quitting, that you're just going to keep on pushing through it. But my last question would be, like, if you were to quit, like, what would you even do with your time if you did?
I guess I would just focus on acting. I mean, I enjoy acting, too. It's great.
I love
doing both.
So you wouldn't really quit then. You would just be acting instead.
Oh, right. Yeah. But I suppose I feel like in my heart, my creative heart, that I'm a director who can act. And I'm not even sure I'm a great actor. I can memorize lines. I can say them. I can do inflection. And it doesn't really fulfill me as much as, just getting a team together and creating this whole thing. And I guess I'd be an actor, but I'm in Germany and I speak with an American accent, so I'm very limited as far as the roles I could get. I don't think that's gonna happen anytime soon. It's just a thought, you know, like both of you just mentioned, it's a thought that comes into your head and then you just shake it off and goes, that was a silly thought. I gotta make movies.
Yeah, I guess it depends on how long that feeling lasts. Like for me, it lasted long enough where I'm just like, I've gotta walk away for a little bit and see if my passion even comes back. And if it's gone, cool. It's gone, I'm done. Let's walk away from this. But I have had this feeling at least once a year for like the last 10 years where you're just like, what am I doing with my life? Like, does this even matter? Is it all adding up to anything? Why am I working so hard? No one cares. And then a few weeks later, it goes away and I'm just as passionate as I ever was. So if it is just a temporary feeling, stick with it. Feel it for a little bit. It's totally normal to feel it. Everyone I've talked to has felt it, and then get back to it. But I do feel like if you've been feeling this for a while, you might need to just take some time away and just be okay that if the passion doesn't come back. Colin Levy once told me, like, you know, like after I was really discouraged by The Spirit Machine, I was just like, I just feel like I really missed the mark. He just like, take some time, you know, re-aim and then try for the bullseye on the next one. And I've been waiting for that feeling of like, I'm ready to like try to hit the bullseye again, and it hasn't come. But that is, I think, what it takes for me to like feel like I'm ready to make another film, is that I have the answers. I know how to like hit the bullseye this time. I'm not just going to make a movie to make a movie. Like, I'm really going to try really hard to make the best movie that I can make. And that to me is always going to be like trying to like thread the needle, hit the bullseye, blow people away. And it's not easy when you're at our level to do that when you don't have money and you don't have resources. But I think if you put your mind to it, I mean, we've seen a lot of examples of people that have done a lot with the little. So sometimes it just takes time, and it's not a light bulb moment for everyone. Not everyone's gonna make that brilliant thing right out the gate, and it might take time. And I don't think it should ever end based on your age. So I don't want to worry. I don't want to say it's a young man's game. I think it's just. In some ways, it's kind of perseverance. Yeah,
obviously,
right?
Clint Eastwood's still making movies, but he started when he was a young man. I think there's something about ambition, you know, that the people that succeed are very ambitious and driven. And I feel that I do not have that character trait, that I am ambitious enough not to give up, but not to, like I said, I don't need the money. I don't need the fame. I don't need to make the next blockbuster. You know, it's a humble desire.
Find satisfaction in that. Then that would be my advice to you. Like, try to, again, stay in your lane, look around you and take stock of what you do have and not what you don't have. Cause you can really focus on the things you don't have, and that'll make you super, super unhappy. So sometimes you just have to look at what you do have and what you have accomplished, and, you know, pat yourself on the back and be like, I'm doing it. I'm making it happen. I know it doesn't look like the dream that I wanted, but if I were to go back in time and show my like 15-year-old self what I was doing, like, he would think it was pretty cool, actually, living in Germany and acting and making movies.
Hmm. Yes, this is true. Sometimes I forget these things. It's always good to be reminded. That's why I think that your podcast is so valuable to the listeners, because it just reminds them, because especially in this business, I mean, I imagine every business has similar, but this is so ego driven and so superficial, so money driven. It's hard to forget that, that since we're still doing it, that's sometimes enough.
I think so. I think it is.
So I think we need to wrap it up now. But any last final words or final thoughts, anybody?
Well, you guys used to do the 5 questions. Do you still do that? I haven't heard it in the last few.
I think we dropped the 5 questions.
Yeah, okay.
Just because people were saying they were sort of boring.
Right.
Yeah.
Because you just asked me like what I would tell my young self. So it reminded me of that question that you guys used to ask.
Well, let's do this one final question. If you could go back in time and give yourself one piece of advice, what would it be?
It sounds corny, but I guess don't give up. Which is weird that I'm saying that. I guess I am. Yeah. So I would have wished I had better advice to tell my young self.
Right.
Maybe the better advice would be get a real job. I don't know. But I've been very fortunate to have my mother supporting me since I was a kid, since I wanted to be a stuntman before I wanted to be an actor. And she never discouraged me from that. So I've always been lucky to have people around me that have supported me and weren't worried about money or fame or success in the typical terms. So, I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for a lot. And I guess you guys are too.
Yeah, definitely. Well, where can people find out more about you and the stuff that you're working on?
My website is www.anikafilms.com. Anika is spelled A-N-I-K-A. And on Facebook, it's Anika Films. On Instagram, it's Anika Films. Twitter is Anika Films. I don't use social media very often, or I try not to. But those places would be good places to start. And there you can see my showreel. And if there are any producers out there with a boatload of money, give me a call.
Yeah, nice. Give me a call too.
Or even a little bit of money, right?
Yeah. Just, you know, $50 would be cool. Let's just start small and see where we go. You know?
Right.
A couple
just pay
beers
for lunch for the 3-person crew.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's always helpful. All right. Well, thanks everybody for listening. If you want to get in contact with us, you can send an email to podcast@makingmoviesishard.com. Where you can also visit our website at makingmoviesishard.com. Where you can find links to things we talked about on this episode, including all of Jean-Luc's old short films, if we can find them, and the Living in Limbo trailer. I don't know if Limbo's online yet, but if it is, Limbo, and everything else. You can also find us on Twitter and Facebook with the handle at MMIH Podcast. We also have an indie filmmakers group on Facebook, which, if you aren't on there yet, you should get on there. It seems to be growing, all the time, even more, which is great. And finally, if you like the show, you can tell your friends about it or leave a rating for the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. And Jean-Luc, thanks so much for coming on the show, man. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. It was great talking to you.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, Liz. I know that you weren't here for this interview. You probably don't even know who Jean-Luc is. But if he was on the show today, what is a question that you'd ask him?
What's life like in Berlin? I mean, honestly, this is the I don't have a ton of information, so I'd be just curious if what the industry is like. And as an American, are they welcoming to an American in terms of financing and developing his future projects? And what has it been like for the past 5 years for him to work within that entertainment industry? So I'd be very curious about that.
Yeah, and I'd probably also ask, because he's an actor as well, so I would ask him about the acting scene in Berlin and like how that's going in conjunction with his work on his, you know, on his films. Like, you know, has he made another feature? Like, what's going on? Like, what has the success of his first one? What has that been? I would love to know all those questions. But Liz, well, I think it's time for the...
Eric didn't send me a question.
Oh, he didn't. Oh, no. God.
I thought I didn't read it in the outline till right now that I was supposed to ask you a question. In fact, I was going to say that you've been asking me questions too many times the past few segment recordings and that I was due. And I'm going to make a question up for you. I'm going to make, oh, I have a question. Okay. I have a great question. All right. This question comes from me, not from Eric Toms.
Explain what the game is.
All right. The game. Not just a movie with Michael Douglas. It is a segment that we incorporate in our podcast once a week. And it is an indie film quandary, quagmire problem, a hypothetical situation that you may find yourself in. And we like to pop quiz hotshot each other and ask how each other would handle these hypothetical scenarios. I think that's English. I hope so. All right, Ulrich, here's your question for the game, completely improvised by me in this 1 second. Okay.
Amazing.
You have been in development on a genre feature, a sci-fi feature, for the past 3 years. And it is the first director for hire job that you were brought on, that you pitched on, you nailed. It's like a professional achievement for you to even be on board a project. There's some bona fides, right? There's some credited producers and actors attached to it. They are financing the film entirely based on cast. And they reached out to an actor who has expressed some anti-vax, just, you know, like just talking about anti-vax things. You don't know whether they're anti-vax or not, but there's some speculation on whether this actor is anti-vaccination and the whole vaccination culture. You are at a you're at an inflection point where the producers have expressed that they don't want that actor on board. But ultimately, it's your decision. This actor will get your film completely financed, but there is some ethical murkiness about whether they are a good person or not and are using their platform for good or not. What do you do, director? What do you do?
Well, I think I talk to the actor and see, like, get a sense of this and, like, what was the real deal with this comment? What was their meaning behind it? And like, just sort of have a conversation about it and sort of get from the horse's mouth, like the real true information. Like, is this guy an anti-vaxxer, you know, or are they like just like open to other, you know, counterculture concepts? And they're not going to say one way of living is right, one way of living is wrong or whatever it is. Who knows? Like, but just kind of figure it out. And then I think in the end, you know, if the producers are leaving it up to me and this actor, like, A, I like them as a person because I'll have this conversation. So that'll like help me decide if I like them as a person. B, if, you know, like they're right for the role, which I'm assuming they are. And then C, the most important one, like, Are they a bad person? Like, do they have, like, hateful agendas? Like, are they trying to push something that you don't like out into the world? And if that is true, then I don't think you can work with them. But if, like, but if that's not true, and they're like, oh, no, that was just a slip-up. Like, I would never do that. I never speak about politics, like, you know, during an interview about this movie. Like, that's my own business. Like, I'm not trying to, like, push that forward as part of my agenda or like who I am as an actor. Like, that's just something that came out randomly and in an honest mistake or honest whatever. Like, I didn't mean anything by it, but they blew it out of proportion. They did. If it's all that stuff, then yes, I'm in. I'm working with them, you know, and I will defend them and I'll be on their side and I'll tell our producers, like, you guys are being a little too harsh on this person. They're not who you think they are. They're going to be great. And they're not going to do the terrible things you think they might do. And I vouch for them. So that's how I would handle it.
Well,
what about you, Liz?
I probably wouldn't even need a conversation with them. I probably would just be like, yeah, you're in. Because I've come to the point where if they're vax or pro-vax or anti-vax, I don't care. I just don't care. I think that they're allowed their opinion and maybe it's right, maybe it's wrong. And some may think that that individual has responsibility to only dispense objective truth and fact-checked information because they are celebrity on social media. But I think we give celebrities way too much power and influence over our culture. And ultimately, we should probably not put that kind of expectation on them. And they're allowed to make mistakes and they're allowed to have opinions that are different from the general consensus of public health. And that being said, like, I really like your answer. Like, you would want to move past just a tweet, right? A tweet can be very misleading. And so maybe this person is just a lovely individual who, yes, just wants to question everything, which I think is healthy. But my perspective is, if they could finance the film and I think they're right for the role, just like you were saying, I'm okay. I'm okay with them being anti-vax. Yeah. I think if they are spouting Nazi propaganda, no thank you. Like, not interested in that. If they are, you know, it's like, as a pregnant person, I'm not a vegetarian, but I'm normally a vegetarian. And if they're saying things like, you gotta eat meat all the time, it's like, I still would hire them because, you know what, that's just their opinion that they want to eat meat all the time, right? Even if I think they're espousing something that's not great for the environment. Who cares? Let them eat meat. Let them not get vaccinated. That's their business. I want my movie financed. That's how I
feel. Let me ask you a question. What if they were like, I want to use your movie as like a launching board to talk about anti-vax stuff and you know, meatism, you know, and like how meat is the way to live. Like, what if that was part of what they were saying, that they want to use this movie as a vehicle for that? Like,
then
what? Which no human would do, by the way. I don't think.
No, you're right. Like, if that were the conversation that were had, that would make it incredibly more complicated, right? That would make me think like, well, maybe it's not worth it. I would probably lean more against working with that actor. But if it's just like, because I'm not used to an actor really promoting my movie whatsoever. Like, I'm not used to an actor marketing my movie, other than the amazing Christine Weatherup, who did an amazing job with Bread and Butter. But usually the actors that I work with are like, one tweet, thank you very much, move along.
Yeah.
So like, this would be an unprecedented scenario for me. And I probably would, I'd probably not want to work with someone who wanted to utilize our film for what I thought were not the greatest of purposes.
Yeah, but I don't think like anybody...
No one would ever do that, but still, I get
that. Like, it would be like the craziest person in the world who would be like, yes, I am going to talk about it. Nothing but anti-vax and all the interviews for your
and
movie.
And meat-eating. Like, no meat-eating would... anti-vaccination.
I just feel like that's so... outside the box. And I feel like people are so sensitive with tweets and comments taken out of context from an interview. It's just like, come on, let people be people. Come on, man.
People want to get angry about everything. They don't have any sort of sense of like forgiveness or latitude. That's dangerous. I don't want to be a part of that. I don't want to be a part of cancel culture. I want to be part of like rehab culture is what I want to be a part of.
Yes, I agree.
But all of you can always send us a question, comment, or suggestion to podcast@makingmoviesishard.com. If you like the show, you can leave us a review on iTunes. Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter at MMIH Podcast, YouTube at Making Movies Hard Podcast. Thanks to our editor, Jeff Freimuth, for doing the editing. Thanks to our producer, Eric Toms, for being awesome, except for the time where he didn't send us the game question. But actually, he's still awesome. Never mind. Thanks to all of you for listening, and talk to y'all next week.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.